So what I want to do today is I want to finish my discussion of product kernel aggregation. And here I'm going to be skipping a lot, some steps, because, you know, like the natural program is I'll write down the master equations. I'll say some, you know, some basic features about it. Then we would solve for the generating function. And then we would invert the generating function to get a cluster size distribution. The process of solving for the generating function is a little bit advanced. The process of inverting it to get the cluster size distribution is really advanced. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to write down answers. But then we'll say, I'll talk a little bit about the physical consequences of the cluster size distribution. So product kernel aggregation, the problem, you know, the master equations for this was CK dot, time rate of change of the concentrations of clusters of mass K. So it's the summation I plus J equals K. And then I had ij ci cj minus summation over all I. And then it was I, well, okay, so I'll write it out. So then there's ik ci ck. But this sum over all I, ci, this is just nothing more than the total mass in the system by definition. So this sum goes away and we're just left with.
Is there a 1/2?
Oh, thank you. 1/2. So there's a 1/2, I plus J equals K, and then I have I, J, I, C, J, and then here I just have minus K, C, K. So it looks a little bit simpler than what we've seen before. And so what I did last time is said, let's look at the low order moments to see that there's actually something weird buried in these equations. And so I'll define MN, which is equal to summation K to the power N, CK, summation over all K equals 1 to infinity. And then we wrote down the first few moments equations. Let me just do that again, just, you know, so we're all on the same page. So we look at MN dot. So that's equal to summation over all K. And so I have K to the N, which I'll write as I plus J to the power N, IJ, CI, CJ. So that's the first term with a 1/2 in front. And when I sum over all k, it changes this constrained sum over I plus j equals k to two unconstrained sums. So this is now just two unconstrained sums, ij. And then the last term, so if I compute mn dot, I have k to the n, but there's one more power of k. And so the last term always is always going to give me mn plus 1. So if we just do this one by one, so m0 dot. So if I don't have this, then I just have 1/2 ij I c I j c j. And so that's 1/2 m1 squared. And then I have minus m1. And if the mass is conserved, which we think it ought to be, so let's say that the mass is conserved, then this would go to minus 1/2 if m1 equals 1. And so this says that M0 goes like 1 minus T over 2. And when so I integrate this with the initial condition, that if I start with a monomer only initial condition, that means my initial mass, actually it's mass density, my initial mass density is 1. And so you get this. So this is already one thing which is weird, is that the like clusters disappear at time equals 2. M1 dot in the same way. So I have M1, so I have 1/2 I plus J, IJ, IJ, C, I, C, J. So there's two identical terms. So let's just look at one of them. So I have I times I, which is I squared times J. So I squared CI is M2, J, C, J is M1. So we're going to get M1, M2. And here I have minus M2. And again, if M1 equals 1, then this is equal to 0. You know, so if M1 is equal to 1, which is mass conservation. So if I assume mass conservation, I have mass conservation. So things look sort of OK, except that I'm kind of assuming the result at some level. And then the last thing I did last in class last time is if we look at M2 dot, so now when we have I plus J squared, there's going to be three terms. The squared terms will be like a term which is like I squared. I mean, there'll be I squared. And then there's a J squared, but like if I, they're identical in their contributions. So let's look at one of the terms. So there's I squared times I, which is I cubed. So that's going to be M3 and then times J. So it's M3, M1, and there's two such terms. So it's a something looks like M1, M3. And then the cross term, so I have 2 that cancels the 2 here. I have ij, so I have I squared j squared cicj, which is nothing more than plus M2 squared. And then I have minus M3. And so this goes to M2 squared if M1 is equal to 1. And the solution to this equation, M2 dot is equal to M squared, again, M2 squared. Again, for the initial condition that I start with only monomers, this is going to give me M2 of t is equal to 1 over 1 minus t. So exclamation point here, another exclamation point here that something is blowing up. So let me do just one more of these guys just to give you a feeling for what's happening. So if I compute M3 dot, so now I have I plus j cubed, and so there'll be two types of terms. There's like the cubic term, and since both cubic terms give me the same contribution, let's just look at one of them. So I'll have an I cubed times I, which is times ci, which will give me the fourth moment, and then there's a j, I'm sorry, so it's I cubed times I here, I fourth, so it's third moment times first moment. So there's a term that looks like M3M1. And then there's the cross terms, which involves something like 3. And since there's 2 identical terms, I only keep one of them and just forget about the 1/2. So there'll be a term that looks like I squared times j. So I squared will give me I squared times I. So it's M3. And j times this j gives me M2. So there's going to be a term here, which is like can't keep track of my terms here. So I cubed plus 3 I squared j plus 3 I j. I don't expect you to see this. I'm just doing it for myself. So I cubed gives me, fourth moment. Yeah, sorry, fourth moment. That's why. Okay, so it's I cubed times I, j, so it's fourth moment times first moment, and I'll have 2 such terms. And then there's these terms, third moment times second moment. So plus 3 m3 m2. And then I have to subtract away minus m4. And again, if m1 is equal to 1, this goes to 3 m3 m2. But m2, we already know what it is, 1 over 1 minus t. And the solution to this equation is that M3 is equal to 1 over 1 plus T quantity cubed. And if you continue doing this, then what you'll find, for example, is like M4 scales is 1 over 1 equals 1 over 1 minus T to the power 5. So, and you can continue this ad infinitum. So it seems like there's something weird going on with this particular process, because there's a singularity in the zeroth moment at t equals 2, and there's another singularity in all the higher moments at t equals 1 where the mass diverges. And so this is a signal that something weird is going on, and what it's a signal of is a phenomenon called gelation. And so the gelation phenomenon is that at a finite time, when you make your jello and you put the powder in the liquid and you mix it up and you stick it in the fridge, you know, you look at it after a few minutes, it still looks like liquid. And at some point it turns to something else. It turns to another phase of matter, a gel. And what is this gel? It's basically an infinite connected network of molecules that are all touching each other and like grabbing onto each other, so that this material no longer flows like a liquid, but has some aspects of a solid. And so this is a phenomenon of gelation. And so given that fact that a gelation phenomenon exists, we have to reinterpret these equations to include something about this gelation phenomenon. So let's talk about gelation. So what is gelation? Is that your system, which initially consisted of only monomers, breaks up into
one cluster that is macroscopic, that contains a finite fraction of all the molecules in the system. And so there will be a gel phase, which contains a finite fraction of the mass, the total mass. And then there's the sol phase, which is sort of everything else, just the residue that's left behind. And so suppose that our system, you know, like I take my packet of Jell-O out of the pantry and I weigh it, and so it'll have a total mass M. And so if I imagine doing that, I just say for a total mass M, let's call it script M to really make it emphasize that it's a number, it's a finite number, it's a total mass of my packet of Jell-O. And so when I have this total mass M, that says that I should write, let me just remind myself the notation that I use. Got it. Yes. So that's, if there's a total, for a total mass M, then if I look at Mn, the nth moment of the cluster size distribution, so this is equal to summation, I make this look like a sum, summation a to the n ck. But you know, so like in principle, this sum goes from zero to infinity and includes everything in the system. But one has to be a little bit careful here, and I want to distinguish between everything that's in the sol phase and the one cluster that belongs to the gel phase. So I'm going to break this sum up into two pieces. There will be a piece here which I'll call sol, which goes all the way to like everything except the very largest cluster. And then there's a piece in this which is the largest cluster. And so so if the total mass is M and the gel mass, by definition, it's a finite fraction of the total mass. So let's call the gel mass G, which is some number between 0 and 1, times the total mass, because it's by definition, that's a finite fraction of the total mass. And so there'll be a term here plus. So this mass is going to be gm to the nth, and that's the contribution of the gel. Well, so I'm sorry, this is the mass. This is the mass. And then there's one more piece to this, which is that since there's only one cluster of this gel size, and if initially I start with monomers and they'll have capital M monomers, that means that the concentration of the gel is 1 divided by the total number of clusters, and so this is 1 over M. So this is the proper way to write the moments when I have this like singular contribution of like one infinite cluster. And so this is the mass of the infinite cluster or the gel, and this is the concentration of this gel. And so now we can rewrite our answers for the mass, for the moments, and we're going to see that that changes all this stuff here in a fundamental way. So let's look again at M0, the zeroth moment. So this is nothing more than sum, well, k to the zero, so that's 1. So this is sum ck over all k, sol. And then I have plus the mass to the nth power, but when n is 0, that's just 1, and I have 1 over m. So the point here is that for the zeroth moment, the contribution of this infinite cluster is negligible because this is like infinitesimally small. So we don't have to worry about it for the zeroth moment. But for the first moment, which is in some sense the total mass of the system, so for the first moment, that's the total mass. And somewhere we're going to write that as sum kck. Sol phase. And then I have plus the mass of the largest of this infinite cluster, which is gm to the power 1, divided by 1 over m. And so this is nothing more than summation kck, kck plus g, because the m's cancel. And so here, in this particular case, the contribution of the gel phase makes a finite correction to the total mass of the system. So I could write that the gel concentration is equal to 1 minus summation kck. So it's a finite correction for the first moment. On the other hand, if I look at the higher moment, say m2, the second moment, so that's summation k squared ck all phase plus gm, which is the mass, now squared, divided by its concentration, which is m. And so this is equal to summation k squared ck all phase plus g squared m. And because m can be as large as you want, if you know, it's like macroscopic number, this is a huge correction to this thing. So the point is that the contribution of the gel has nothing, it has nothing to say about the correction to the number of clusters or the concentration of clusters. It makes a finite contribution to the first moment, and it makes an infinite contribution to the second moment and also all higher moments. So the point here is that if I go back to my equations, then, you know, this divergence is like somehow has to be modified by the existence of this infinite cluster. And as we're going to see, it then feeds back into like the equation for the zeroth moment. So there's no singularity at t equals 2. There's only a singularity at time equals 1. So, I mean, I'm kind of glossing over a little bit of detail here because there's some mathematical subtleties that I just, you know, it would take like 2 lectures to go through all the mathematical subtleties. But I just want to give you a sense. There's something really weird about a product kernel aggregation. And yeah.
For monomers, we had a similar master equation, but we didn't have any singularities.
Monomers. What do you mean monomers?
I mean, just monomers combining together to form polymers.
Right.
There's no gelation there.
Well, no. The point is that, you know, the each cluster size has like some evolution equation. You know, monomers, they only disappear. Dimers are created by monomers joining, and then they disappear because they interact with anybody else. So for every single size, there is an equation, which is always involving a gain term and a loss term. But the point is that because the reaction rate is growing so rapidly with mass as the clusters develop and you get like a tail to the cluster size distribution, the rate at which large clusters interact becomes so quick that in a finite time, you will develop an infinite size cluster. So, I mean, the monomers don't, you know, they're kind of boring in this case because they're just residue left behind. All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to tell you the answer for the cluster size distribution, and then I'll look at some consequences of this cluster size distribution. So it turns out that the answer for CK of T is actually quite beautiful, and it turns out to be K to the power K minus 2. Over k factorial t to the power k minus 1 e to the minus kt. So it's a little bit more involved than what we saw for constant kernel aggregation, but it's a, you know, it looks innocent. But it turns out that this functional form has a lot of beauty and a lot of interesting aspects to it. So let's look at this thing in a limit of large k, and also let's look at the limit of the right range of time. And so it turns out that what's interesting, so first of all, let's look for k going to infinity. What happens then? For k going to infinity, I'll apply Stirling's approximation for the k factorial. And so hopefully you remember, maybe I'll just stick it over here, k factorial, that's equal to k to the k times square root of 2 pi k. That's Stirling's approximation. And so that's what I'm going to use here. So k to the k, so in fact, that kills this guy here. And then I have 2 pi, so I have, but it's downstairs. So it's the 1 over square root of 2 pi. And then I have k to the 1/2 downstairs from the k factorial, and then there's two more uncancelled powers of k here, so there's a 1 over k to the power of 5 halves. And then let me write this guy here as e to the...
Is it k to the power of 3 halves?
What?
No, 5 halves.
5 halves. And so this I'll write as e to the k minus 1 log t minus kt. And again, you have to like stare at this for a while, but it turns out that the interesting range for this distribution is for t approaching 1. We saw already here for the higher moments that when t approached 1, something weird happened. Here you see that for small t, this looks like exponential decay, and it's sort of fighting with a power law decay, and so there might be some competition between power law decay and exponential. But let's make that a bit more explicit. Let's now choose t is equal to close to 1, 1 minus epsilon. And let's just see what happens as we send, as epsilon goes to 0. So in this limit, ck of t, asymptotic scales is 1 over the square root of 2 pi, 1 over k to the power 5 halves. And let me maybe do a little worksheet over here. So I have k minus 1 log t minus kt. And since we're friends here, I hope, and we're interested in the limit of like large k, then let me replace k minus 1 by k. So this I'm going to write as roughly k. And then I have log of t, which is 1 minus epsilon, minus k, and so t, which is minus k, 1 minus epsilon. And so this, I'm missing a k somewhere. Let me just check, because something is bugging me that I don't quite see. Yeah, I'm missing a simple e to the k, and I just don't see where I'm missing it. T to the k and log t minus k. I'm missing something. What am I missing?
Is it in Stirling's approximation? Isn't there also an e to the k?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Jesus Christ. K over e to the power k. Thank you. You saved my life. Okay. So we using Stirling's approximation properly. So now we have k factorial, so that means that there's an e to the k upstairs. So there's an e to the k upstairs, so there's plus k. All right, so this, and now everything is fine. So here I have plus k, plus k. And so let's now just do a Taylor series expansion. So here I have k, and so expanding this, I get minus epsilon squared over 2, plus dot, 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 that I'll forget about, minus k, plus k epsilon, plus k. So that cancels this guy. This guy cancels that guy. And then I'm left with minus k epsilon squared over 2. And so this is e to the minus k over 2. And then epsilon was 1 minus t squared. Let me make this more clear. So k over 2. So that's what the cluster size distribution looks like asymptotically.
Good question. Wait, sorry. Why is it okay to drop the 1 in the k minus 1, like the k minus 1 lnt?
Yeah, it is.
How come?
Well, okay, so let's suppose we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Then, okay, so then I'd have k minus 1, and so there'd be another term here, a minus, there'd just be something minus epsilon. But, when k is large, I can forget epsilon compared to k.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's certainly kosher.
Oh, we are taking k to infinity. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
But you have k epsilon squared in the other term, and you have epsilon here. was to say k epsilon squared is not in the same order as epsilon when k is.
Well, you know, again, I say I'll fix an epsilon, and then there'll be a k large enough where I can forget about epsilon compared. Yeah. Yeah. No, trust me. I mean, again, it's like I may be being a little bit glib and quick about this, but when things like this that I'm skipping, it's like, trust me. And if you don't trust me, then go, you know, tonight, you know, check and you'll see that it's certainly correct. Okay. So anyways, so where am I? So the upshot of all of this is that Ck of t, or k going to infinity and t approaching 1 from below. So normally we write it this way to make it to say which way we're approaching 1. We're approaching it from below. This thing has asymptotic scaling 1 over the square root of 2 pi, k to the 5 halves, e to the minus k over k star. So it's exponential decay. When k with k star, the sort of characteristic range over which the exponential decay occurs is 2 over 1 minus t squared. So that's the point, is that near gelation. So we see that when t approaches, so for t like less than 1, this will be exponential decay. As t approaches 1, so the distribution will look something like this. So if I'm plotting now log of k and log ck, so there'll be a range where there's slope of minus 5 halves and then it drops off, and this is k star. So this is at early time. At a little bit later time, it looks something like this. Drops off. And still later time, oh, that's another green chalk. Okay, yellow. And still later time, it looks something like this and drops off. So this is late time. And this guy here was early time. And so when you have a power law distribution of cluster sizes, that means there's no natural scale in the problem, which means that it's like self-similar on all scales. And so the gelation transition is an example of a phase transition. It's a second order phase transition. It's kind of the same as percolation, what we talked about a little bit when I mentioned a bit about the renormalization group. And so again, here one has the same kind of a feature, that there is a part that has no scale in it. This is the scale-free part of the distribution. And then this is the part that has a natural scale in it, which is this characteristic size scale. And so as t approaches 1, the range over which you have scale-free behavior gets larger and larger until it's in the entire system. And that is the gelation transition. Yep. So that's everything I wanted to say about the whole process of aggregation kinetics. So any questions?
Is t the mass of the system at time t, or is it time itself?
No, t is really the time. The total mass in the system, you know, again, is going, well, the total mass by definition is like, or the total mass density is 1. I'm saying the total mass in the system is the script m. If I divide by the volume of the system, at the total mass divided by the volume, I've chosen that to be 1. So that's always 1 throughout the entire, you know.
Why are we taking t to be 1 minus epsilon?
Because that's sort of, see this exponential factor here, it's like, what is it doing? And so, you know, if you look at it carefully, one sees that as t is approaching 1, that it has linear dependence on k with a coefficient that is diverging or going to 0 as t approaches 1. So it's a signal that there's a phase transition going on in the system. That's why I was focusing on t equals 1. So for t beyond 1, for example, then the point here, and I'll have more to say about this, like maybe this lecture or next lecture, is that, you know, this mass of the gel it's, well, okay, like right at the phase transition, the mass of the gel is exactly equal to, well, we can calculate it, but the point is that it's a finite mass, but it's an infinitesimal fraction of the total mass. Beyond t equals one, the gel is actually a finite fraction of the total mass as well. So right at the phase transition, when t is equal to one, this gel fraction is actually equal to zero. But it's equal to zero in a very interesting way. It turns out that if I have n sites or n monomers in my system, the mass of the gel is actually n to the 2/3. And so if you divide by n, it's an infinitesimal fraction, but it's still huge. So I don't know if I've quite answered your question. Okay, yes.
The discussion kind of goes back a bit, and maybe you already explained it, but can you give us a more intuitive understanding of like the moments? Like I know M1 is related to the mass.
Right.
It is the mass.
Right.
What exactly are all the other moments?
Higher moments are kind of like probing more detailed structural features of an underlying distribution. So, you know, given any distribution, whatever it is, you know, here's some distribution. Well, actually, let me draw something that's something a little bit simpler. You have a distribution that looks like that. So if I look at the first moment, you will find that the first moment is somewhere very close to the peak. The second moment, if you take the second moment minus the first moment squared, it'll tell you something about the width. But you know, it doesn't say anything about like, well, what's happening here? Is this a long tail or not? But if you look at higher moments, and there are things called cumulants of the distribution. So there's the skewness, because this distribution is obviously not symmetrical. And it turns out there's a quantity related to the third moment that measures the skewness. And then there's something related to the fourth moment called kurtosis that measures, is the distribution fat or skinny? And so so as you look at higher moments, you're actually probing more detailed structure of the distribution itself.
Is there any way of seeing what about like very, very high moments? Like, because here we've got certain ideas for the first maybe four moments.
Right.
What about like the 217? What does that tell?
Usually for, you know, like, for example, we think about like a Gaussian distribution. The Gaussian distribution has a very special property because only the first two cumulants are non-zero. All other higher cumulants are exactly equal to zero. So in general, one doesn't really look beyond maybe the fourth moment because it's like kind of like geeky information. Like if it turns out that there's like another little bump here or something like that, then, you know, by doing something with 217th moment, is that the moment you're interested in? The 273rd? You know, then it'll tell you something about this little bump that's sitting here. But typically distributions are smooth and have a single or maybe two peaks. And so only one's looking at usually the first four moments or the first four cumulants, because they're physically the ones that are relevant.
Why is that true? Like, why? I don't quite understand like why the structure of just the mathematical structure of the moments would give us like the features of the distribution.
Well, I mean, so I guess what I would say is, well, let's go back and just think about, all right, so first of all, so I would argue M1 tells you where the peak is.
What does
M0 is just normalization. That, you know, that's, okay, if the distribution is normal. So okay, so M0 is normalization. And so the second moment by itself is usually not the most useful thing, but what one looks at is M2 minus M1 squared. This is called the second cumulant. And it turns out that this tells you about the width of the distribution. And then there's the third cumulant, which, you know, is related to like M3 and M2 and M1, and I forget what the combination is, but there's some combination of M3, M2, and M1, which is called the skewness, and it measures like, is it, you know, tilting to the right or tilting to the left? And then there's something with the fourth moment called the kurtosis, is measuring like, is it, you know, fat or skinny? And it's sort of like the same as like oblate versus prolate spheroids in mechanics. And so those are the ones that people normally look at. And and that's sort of like the grossest features of a distribution. Where is its peak? How wide is it? Is it skewed? And, you know, is it a wider fat distribution?
But is there any way of like, I get, maybe it would take like a lot of derivations to show why that's true with those features coming from those specific moments. Would it?
Yeah, no. Well, this we would have to work out an example and just see that in fact the appropriate skewness kurtosis is telling you something about that. So if you go to the Wikipedia page about like skewness and kurtosis, it'll have some examples of exactly what you're asking about.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So yeah, I guess now this is the last formal thing that I had planned for the course itself, and that was complex networks. And so this is a very different topic. And again, I have no idea like what your exposure has been to this whole area, but maybe about 20 years ago, there was a sudden explosion of interest in complex networks. And a number of very important papers were published. And it turns out that it's a really beautiful exemplar of a non-equilibrium statistical physics. So the last topic of this class is going to be complex networks. And so before I talk about complex networks, let's talk about simple networks and the dichotomy between simple networks and complex. Yes?
You said here at late times the K-star gets bigger and bigger, but what do you mean by late times? If t goes to 1, k-star becomes infinity.
That's right. And so that is where the phase transition has occurred. So yeah, so you could t can go off to infinity. And so when t goes off to infinity, then the point is that, as I think I mentioned when we're discussing percolation, that the relevant quantity is like the analog of the susceptibility is the mean cluster size of the finite clusters. So beyond the gel point, like the gel is a finite fraction, the residue left behind is really tiny. And so if I look at the average cluster size, so size average of the finite clusters only, then it's doing something like this as a function of time. It's diverging, and it has a big peak, and then it goes back down again. And the more mass you put in the system, the higher this peak is going to be. And then if the mass was infinite, it would be an infinite peak. But it's the mean size of the finite clusters that measures, that characterizes the phase transition. And so on either side of the phase transition, there is a sharp peak, which turns into a divergence in the thermodynamic limit.
But in the diagram is the so when t goes to 1, you'll
have a power law over all size scales.
Right. And by the way, for the other model, the rate when the rate was constant, the aggregation rate,
right,
instead of the product kernel aggregation, you had the k star.
Was going like t. Was going like t.
No. The k star went to t squared, I think, and
no.
The total mass went to
t. No, the characteristic size of a cluster grows linearly with time. Whereas here, the characteristics.
Oh.
Yeah.
No. You said k star goes to t squared.
Well, no, but that's for the case of with input.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about irreversible aggregation now. Just no input.
No, but I'm just saying. You said there was something put there, and I wanted to know if you knew what happened, because the total mass went to t.
That's right. So, but the thing is that when I'm inputting mass at a constant rate, that means the total mass in the system is not conserved because I'm always inputting mass.
Yeah.
And so it's just that the finding k star went like t squared was like balancing the total mass under the steady state distribution, which was k to the minus 3/2. And out to some range, and I just wanted to make sure that the integral under that curve was equal to t, and that forced that k star, that characteristic size, to go like t squared.
But that doesn't make sense because your characteristic mass, which I don't know what.
No, but I mean, I think you're confused. I think you're mixing two different things. One is like constant kernel aggregation with no input.
No. I just forgot about that. I just remembered because. You said that there was some sort of a weird thing happening here, and you said, I'm going to talk about this later, maybe in the next lecture.
I was just sort of saying that, like, morally, if you look at the cluster size distribution in aggregation with input that it kind of looked like the turbulence spectrum. That's the point I wanted to try.
It wasn't case totally characteristic mass after which the probability goes to zero.
Exactly.
Okay, so the characteristic mass, which is just the mass, which is the largest cluster size or cluster mass that you have in your system,
right,
goes as t squared.
Right.
But your total mass, which
oh yes, okay, I. Yes, I now understand your question, and I'm sorry I don't have an answer for you yet. But I mean, keep bugging me about it. I will think about it. Okay. All right. Thanks. All right. So complex networks. So first thing is, let's just talk about simple networks versus complex networks. So simple networks. So simple networks are things like a lattice. That's pretty simple. And why is it simple? Because like every point in the lattice looks the same as everybody else. So there's really very little to discuss here. So one is a lattice. Another example is a Cayley tree. So a typical Cayley tree is that you start with a point. It branches out, say, into three, for example. Each of these branches out into three. And then each of these branches out into three, and you just go ad infinitum, and that's called a Cayley tree. And the thing about why this is simple is that the local environment at every single one of these junctions is the same as everybody else. So it still has this feature that it has like no structure in the sense that the environment at every single node of this network is the same as everywhere else. So these are examples of simple networks. Some examples of so-called complex networks, although it's not clear like how complex they really are. So one is the Erdős-Reni random graph. Erdős-Reni. It's got accents in it, I just don't know where they are. Have people heard of this one before? No, some people not. There's something called the Watt-Strogatz network. I'll say more about that momentarily. And then there are what are called scale-free networks. So Erdős-Reni was invented somewhere in the 1950s. Watt-Strogatz is somewhere in the 90s. Scale-free networks I've actually been around for like more than 100 years, but it was kind of re-recognized only like around the year 1998. And this has led to a burgeoning of effort in understanding the geometrical properties of complex networks. So let's begin with the Erdős-Reni random graph, because that's perhaps the simplest example of that. And at this stage, maybe if I can have the screen coming down, because I have one thing I just want to show. Thank you. So, okay, so let's ignore this just for a moment. But so Erdős-Reni. Oh, I guess, can you see this still? Sort of? Okay, well, I'm only going to write very little at this stage. So it turns out there's two generic flavors of the Erdős-Reni random graph. One is you start with n nodes, so n isolated nodes. So n nodes, I'll write this really big so hopefully you can see it. So there's n nodes, and you imagine just sprinkling down links that join random nodes anywhere, no geometric structure. And you just put down NL links. So that's one version of Erdős-Reni. You have N fixed, so this is fixed. And this you can vary. And the point is that, you know, since you have N nodes, the number of pairs is N minus 1 over 2. And so if you imagine like each one of those n minus one pairs of nodes is connected by a link, then everything will be connected. You'll have a complete graph. So as you change L, you'll go from a situation where you have little isolated clusters to like a macroscopic cluster. So in fact, the Erdős-Rényi random graph has a version of the percolation transition, which is also a version of the gelation transition. And you know, one can study it in that way. So there's another version of Erdős-Rényi random graph, which is you can have n fixed, and you could have p, the probability that a link is present. So this is the link probability. And a lot of mathematicians have spent a lot of effort understanding the difference between the NL version and the NP version. And so what I want to present to you now is my version, which is a dynamical version of the Erdős-Rényi random graph. And it turns out that, as you're going to see momentarily, this dynamical version is very simple, and it allows you to understand features of it in a very appealing way. So here's my Erdős-Rényi random graph. I start with n isolated nodes. And so I wrote here n squared over 2 pairs. It's really n minus 1 over 2. But since we're friends here, we'll forget the minus 1. And what we do now is imagine that we're just sprinkle bonds at random at a fixed rate. So, you know, coming in from above, I throw down a toothpick, and I throw down another toothpick, and I just do this at some fixed rate. So here are my links coming in at some rate. And so you see that I'm gradually connecting up my clusters. And so now I have, in this case, I've got 3 clusters and 3 isolated sites. And the thing is that I, as the user, am free to choose my input rate to be anything I want. And if I choose my input rate to be in a convenient way, it turns out that it's really helpful to understand the nature of the problem. So one last thing I have to write here, which is that a natural characteristic of these nodes is the degree of a node. So node degree. So the node degree is defined as the number of links impinging on a node. So this is the number of links attached to a node. And if you look at this picture here, well, it turns out if I want to compute, say, the degree of some nodes, like this isolated node has degree 0. The two guys with the, you know, at the very left, they both have degree 1. There's some nodes with degree 3 and 4 and all that. And so a natural characteristic of this thing is the average degree of my network. And again, for a lattice network, every node has exactly the same degree. But it turns out there's a very simple macroscopic way of understanding what is the average degree at any point in the network. Because if you think about any given link, each link, so here is a node, here is another node, here is a link between them. Let me break the link. Can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Okay. If I break the link, then each link contributes 1 to the degree of every single node. And so if I just do that, imagine taking every link and chopping it in half and then looking, then that means that the degree of the average degree will be the total degree of the entire network divided by the total number of nodes. But the total degree is twice the number of links, because each half of a link contributes 1 to the number of links at each node. So that says that the node degree D is equal to 2L over N. So with that information, I'm going to choose my input rate of links in a very special way. I'll choose it to be n over 2. And why do I do that? Because that says that the number of links at time t is the input rate, which is n over 2, times the time. And so that's nt over 2 at time t. But then the average degree, which is twice the number of links divided by n, is exactly equal to t. So it turns out choosing this input rate is very convenient, because it says that the average degree of each node grows linearly with t to the coefficient 1. And as we're going to see, that allows us to compute the degree distribution in a very simple way. OK, so I think this is a good place to have like a 4-minute break. Let's do that. Reconvene in 4 minutes. I won't go anywhere. And if you want to ask questions, great. If not, yes. No. Yeah.
By starting with n squared over 2 pairs?
So the thing is that if I have n isolated nodes, and I say, like, how many possible pairs of nodes are there? It's n times you know, I have one node, I have n nodes, so here's, I'm one of the n nodes. How many ways can I link to each one of you? So it's, I have to link to every one of us in the room, which is n minus one. So n minus one over two, but you know, the two comes because I could have picked myself first or I could have picked you first. And so that's a potential number of links that could exist.
But no links
yet. Not yet.
Is this for very large n?
This is for any n.
No, because n choose two.
That's right. N minus one over two.
Yeah, but this n squared.
Right. So I said, but let's since we're friends here, we're gonna say n is large and we'll forget the one. Okay.
That's
yes.
What,
yeah.
Large n, so,
yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes.
What is the meaning of this average degree exactly? Because you said
what's a natural.
Yeah, for each link, you say you have 2 degrees, but
no.
Why don't you divide by n? Because
so the thing is that
what is the fraction of the nodes that are contributing into the?
Well, I'm just trying to compute what is the average degree of the nodes in this network, and the average degree is going to be the total degree divided by the total number of nodes.
Yeah.
And the total degree is the total number of like things coming into every single node, but each little stub coming into a node is half of a link. Because I took a link and chopped into two, and so each stub coming in is part of a link, and there's two stubs per link.
Yeah, and what do you mean by the last sentence, the red one?
Well, so the thing is that what we see here is that the average degree is proportional to t, is equal to t, not proportional, it's exactly equal to t.
Mm-hmm.
And so that says that the average degree increases by one every time the time goes by one. And so it's, you know, these are all Poisson processes. Like I'm not sort of saying at every tick of a clock, I'm putting in a new bond. I'm just saying at some rate, bonds are coming in. And so if it's a Poisson process where the average degree is growing linearly with time, so that means that the average degree is undergoing a Poisson process such that at rate one, you increase by one.
Okay, so for example, what you did there is that you said, I'm introducing links at rates n over 2, which is n over 2, the dimension of that is 1 over second, let's say, 1 over time.
Yes. Yeah. And again, I'm free to choose my input rate to be anything I want, and I just chose it to be this for convenience only.
Yeah, but then and only then this is equal to t.
That's right. That's right, but that's the case I want to consider, because as you're going to see that we have a very simple equation for the degree distribution, which, you know, in the case of lattice networks, we saw that every node had exactly the same degrees. Nothing very interesting to think there. But in the case of complex networks, an interesting variable that characterizes the structure of the network is the so-called degree distribution. What is the fraction of nodes of a given degree? So that's what we're going to compute in 2 minutes, I guess. Yes. By the way, Big Brother, you can take away the screen now. I think I'm done with it. Thank you. Degree distribution. Well, maybe I'll wait. These two guys come back. So, so what we saw is that the average degree grew by one, and it was done by a random Poisson process. So let me define nk. This will be the fraction of nodes of degree k. And what I want to ask, like, well, how does this fraction change as a function of time as I'm adding more links to the system? So what we see now is that the degree was evolving by a Poisson process with a rate 1. And so that means that the fraction of nodes of degree k is increasing according to a Poisson process. And so the rate equation for the number of nodes of degree k is just obeying a Poisson process. So dnk by dt. So it grows because I have a node of degree k minus 1, and a link comes to it and converts it to a node of degree k. And because this happens at rate 1, the coefficient out in front is 1. So there's minus nk minus 1 minus nk. So this is the equation, the classic equation for a Poisson process. And so maybe as an exercise for you guys, there's many different ways to solve this set of equations. One way is you can just solve this one by one. So we can imagine starting with nodes, all our nodes have degree 0. And then, you know, we just write down sequentially the equations and you'll get some.
Degree 0 was...
Pardon me?
This equation doesn't work with degree 0.
Say that again.
K equals 0?
Yeah.
It doesn't work. I mean, it's k minus 1.
Well, no, the point... Okay, so let me just maybe write it out to be really clear. So dn0 by dt is equal to minus n0. Minus n0. There's no gain term. That you can't create, you know, nothing out of nothingness. But dn1 by dt is equal to n0 minus n1. And then dn2 by dt, dt is equal to n1 minus n2, dot, 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 dot. So it's just the idiosyncratic equation for n0. Anyway, so there's two ways you can solve it. One is we can solve this one by one. Clearly, n0 is decaying exponentially with time. And then you can plug it into here. And then I showed like how you would, you know, use the integrating factor to solve for n1, solve for n2, dot, dot, dot. And so hopefully this is an exercise you can do. Or if you really want to be kind of clever about it, you can do it by the generating function technique. Both cases, you get the same result, be better. Nk is equal to t to the k over k factorial e to the minus kt.
T to the k.
So that's the answer for the degree distribution. And because of the k factorial and the e to the minus kt, this is something which is rapidly decaying as a function of k. So the degree distribution is what's called a narrow degree distribution narrow degree distribution, not scale free. And so that's the basic feature about this type of network. Can't remember my notes on here. Okay, so that's one feature of this network. The other feature, which is of some interest, is the cluster size distribution. And this, you'll see now why I spent some time discussing product kernel aggregation, because a cluster size distribution is just that of product kernel aggregation. So cluster size distribution. So again, we have our endpoints. And people that are like joined together by links, we'll define that to be a cluster. And so the natural measure of a cluster size is the number of nodes in a connected cluster. And that's what I want to compute, is this cluster size distribution. And so let me call Ci will be the concentration of clusters of mass I. And so how does this change? And the crucial point here is that if you think back to that little movie I showed, it's just that if I have a cluster of mass I, so here's some cluster. Try and draw the links and the nodes sort of on top of each other. So here's one cluster. Here's another cluster. You know, they all have different structures. I don't care. But the point is that what is the rate at which a link will join these two clusters together? Well, I have to pick a node on this cluster, and I have to pick a node on that cluster. And how many? And so, if I have a if the concentration of imers is C sub I, the number of nodes will be proportional to the number of nodes of this. So the probability of picking a cluster of mass I and a cluster of mass j and joining them together is nothing more than Kij, this reaction rate will be ICi, so it's the concentration of clusters times the number of possible places you can join to, times JCj. So this is nothing more than product kernel aggregation. So we now know how to derive everything because we've already derived it. And so we've found from previously that the cluster size distribution, and now it kind of has a very clear physical interpretation. It's the number of points in a connected cluster of links. So Ck of t, and so this is equal to, again, k to the k minus 2 over k factorial, t to the power k minus 1, e to the minus kt. So that's the distribution. And what we saw also is that in the limit of large time, I mean, limit of large mass, and as t is approaching one, this distribution has a very nice scaling form, 1 over the square root of 2 pi, 1 over the power k to the power 5 halves, e to the minus k over k over 2, 1 minus t squared. So our distribution, again, I'm kind of harping on this because I'm going to show something interesting about this distribution in just a moment. So what my distribution looks like as a function of k, so let me plot log of ck versus log of k. So the when this argument is close to zero, which corresponds to either small k or t approaching one, then we can forget about the exponential. And we just have power law decay. And then there's going to be a cutoff when this argument to the exponential sort of passes through one, and then there'll be some exponential cutoff. So on a double log plot, my distribution will look something like this. And this point here is k star. And so this is the basic feature of the cluster's mass distribution, or the cluster size distribution. One thing that I want to sort of point out, because it's actually interesting and kind of fundamental, which is that, you know, like when you look at a cluster, the sort of cluster size distribution, you might ask the following question. If you have n total sites and you run the system to like t.99, how big is the biggest cluster? How big is it? And it turns out that this sort of falls into the framework of what's called extreme value statistics. So it's a branch of statistics that's worried about extreme values. And it turns out that there's lots of sort of physical, neat, and interesting features associated with extreme value statistics. So to give you a sense of this, here's another extreme value statistics problem. And I mentioned this because when I was a first year graduate student and we had like some sort of qualifying exam or something like that, you know, you stand in front of some professors and someone says, so what's the energy of the most energetic molecule in this room? That woke people up. What's the energy?
I don't know. It could be infinity.
No, come on. But that's an example of an extreme value statistics problem. But you know, the thing is that these sorts of problems that show up in all kinds of important things, like how big should you build a dam so that it won't be overtopped by the largest flood? And so a lot of, and you know, like, or you know, there's lots of questions like this related to droughts and floods and things of that nature. So it's of interest to understand, like, what is the extreme? So what is sort of the largest mass? So that's what I want to spend a little bit of time doing. So this is sort of like extreme value statistics 101, basically.
An energy distribution probability.
But there is an energy distribution in the room, right? Maxwell Boltzmann.
Yeah, Maxwell Boltzmann distribution, but
there's a finite number of particles.
That's right. Good point. Exactly the point. There's a finite number of particles.
The total.
So somebody's got to be the most energetic. So somebody in this room has got the most money. And so, like, we could ask how much money has the most
The energy of everything else is zero?
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, the average energy of the molecules in the room is like a 40th of an electron volt, right? That's kT. So, and how many molecules are in this room? I don't know, 10 to the 30th, something like that. So of these 10 to the 30th molecules, each of which has an energy of the order of a 40th of an EV, somebody by bad luck has gotten smashed by some fairly energetic molecules is moving relatively quickly. How quickly is that guy moving? It's a well-defined question. I don't get it. What's bugging you?
I don't know how to calculate that.
Well, no, but I'm going to show you. That's the whole.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So how do we find the extremes? So statistics of extremes.
Before you go on, explain again what Kij was in this case, because before it was the rate of aggregation, now it's the rate of things.
It's the same aggregation rate, because you're just having two clusters on this Erdős-Reni random graph that happen to be separated, and then a bond magically comes from above and joins them together.
So you for a cluster of, and then mass is the number of
nodes
in a particular
exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense, but I'm confused about the dimensions. Let's say if this has a concentration, so CI has a concentration dimension.
No, so CI, so capital CI would be the number of clusters of a given size. Little CI is the number of clusters divided by N, the total size of the lattice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And there is because it's a Poisson distribution, everything is, the probability equal, so I over N is the probability, because you have ICI times JCJ.
Right, so the thing is that I'm asking, like, what is the rate at, like, a cluster of mass I and cluster of mass J comes together? So first I have to pick a cluster of mass I. I pick it with probability CI over N. I mean, CI, little CI, the concentration. I pick a cluster of mass J with a probability CJ. But then what's the probability that they join? I have to first pick a node in CI, in the I cluster, and, you know, to attach a link to, and it attaches somebody in the J cluster, and there's J such places to join.
The probability is CI, which is something over N.
Right.
The number of all of those over N. That's because it's a Poisson distribution? Because it's
that's the right measure of, like, the probability of picking somebody. It has nothing to do with Poisson distribution.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's do statistics of extremes. So let me just do the absolute simplest example. So suppose you're given an exponential distribution. So given, like, you know, f of x is equal to e to the minus x. So this probability, and so let's say we have a variable x and we're choosing it from an exponential probability. So imagine you're doing a simulation and I'm saying, you know, make a random number generator and generate for me like a million values of x chosen from this distribution. What's the largest value of x that you're going to find? And so that's what I want to try and show. And so, you know, we have already that integral e, you know, that f of x dx from 0 to infinity, that equals 1, just by construction. And so now I want to estimate x max, which is a function of the number of realizations. So it depends on n, as you point out, it involves finite n. So what's the biggest I can expect to get? And so the way here is a sort of a C to the pants way of estimating that, which is that if I take the integral from x max to infinity of f of x and multiply by n, so you're not happy?
what I said, the maximum energy of a particle could be infinity. So if you assume that you have a Maxwell, isn't the integral taken over minus infinity to infinity for the velocity?
No, but there's only a finite number of particles. You can't do that. Like, just bear with me 2 minutes, and then if you're still bothered, like, ask again. The point is that if I have n variables, there will be one largest variable. And the one way to estimate is to say the following statement, which is that if I integrate from, first of all, if I integrate from 0 to infinity f of x dx, by definition, that's n, because I have n particles, and this integral is 1. But if I integrate from x max to infinity, n, that means there's sort of one particle in this range. Christ, I keep killing in this chalk. There's one particle in the range x max to infinity. This is an estimate of x max. So this is sort of like extreme value statistics 101, the most basic result, which is how to estimate the size of the largest variable. And so if we do this integral, so, you know, we have e to the minus x, we integrate from x max to infinity, that's e to the minus x max times n equals 1. And from this, you get that x max scales as log n. So that's...
Wait, sorry, but that integral, it doesn't tell you, like, you're going... It doesn't tell you, like, the integral x max to infinity of f of x dx doesn't tell you you're finding one particle. It's just...
Well, as I said, this is kind of a rough and sleazy way to estimate this thing. So again, pictorially, you know, you have your imagine now I'm doing the simulation. So here is x, and here I find my variables. I find them all over the place. Lots of variables down here, not so many over here. And now I'm saying I want to find x max is where there's just one point from here off to infinity. And so this is kind of a very rough criterion because I don't know, is it like just right at the cutoff point or is it way over here? And so if you want to find the actual distribution of the maximum, that's another story. But if I just want to estimate where it is, this gives me the right scale for the maximum.
But there what you're really doing is like the integral from f of x to infinity is like... I guess, like...
See, again, the thing is that this is... This is
under the curve.
Pardon me?
It's like the area under the curve. How is that one particle?
Yeah, so the thing is that, look, if I... here's my continuous distribution, and I'm saying that if the area under this curve, when I multiply this thing by n, you know, like the total area under this curve, when I multiply by n, it should be n, right? Because it's all n particles. And the area under this curve here is 1, that says that there's a one particle in this range, which tells me this is a measure for x max.
It's just like probabilistically one particle?
That's right, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
It's like one out of n chance.
Exactly. Exactly so.
Okay.
Okay. So anyways, the thing is that this is only a rough estimate. And as I say, like if you want to do a kosher estimate of the actual full probability distribution of the maximum, that's sort of extreme value statistics 102, which I can show you, but I don't want to do it now because it's sort of taking us off on a tangent. But what I want to do now is use this to like look at what is the largest cluster size over here in the case of the Erdős-Reni random graph. And it turns out there's two different answers depending on whether we're looking at times close to one or times far away from one. So the point is that when the time is far away from one, then my distribution, if I plot log ck versus log k, you know, we'll have like some region which is not very large where there's power law decay, and then it's exponentially cut off. And so it turns out in this case that when we measure the extremal, it's like we're doing something like saying there's one particle in this tiny little range, and we're dominated by the exponential cutoff. So for t less than one, then I would define k max in this case. K max would be defined by the integral from k max to infinity of ck dk. So k max is equal to this, and this is roughly k max to infinity. And so here we have e to the minus k over k star dk. So this is colon. This is the criterion for k max. This thing equals 1 over n. Equals 1 over n. And so if you do this integral, so we'll get k max over k and so we'll get here. K max over K star. Okay, so let me just, sorry, I'm okay. E to the minus K max divided by K star. So that's evaluating the integral is equal to 1 over n. And so I'll get the K max is equal to K star log n. And so this K star is basically log n divided by 1 minus t all squared. So that's result number one, that far away from the transition to this infinite cluster, the characteristic or the largest clusters, you're only growing like log n. Yes?
What happened to the K over 5 by 2?
So I'm basically ignoring it because I'm saying that we're sort of looking at the range over here where the exponential cutoff is playing the major role. And so this part, if you put it in there, you'll get a correction which is even like log n. So it doesn't matter. It's we're interested in the range where the exponential is the dominant factor in this cluster size distribution. So, you know, again, this is one of those things that, you know, when you play this game enough, you realize what you can throw away at the beginning and what you have to keep. And so it's like I'm being a bit glib about it. So, you know, you don't have to necessarily take my word for it. You can actually put in the effect of everything else and you'll see that it doesn't matter.
Why is the exponential decay prominent at that region?
Because I'm saying that I'm interested in the region T much less than 1, where the cluster size, or the cluster distribution is not very broad. And, you know, so just think about, like, you know, I have a million sites, I put down like 1,000 bonds, and I'm asking, like, what's the largest cluster I'll have in that system? And it's going to be like roughly 2 or 3. And so it's like, if I look at the cluster size distribution, it's dominated by the exponential cutoff.
Yeah. Much less than 1, and I understand why the exponential is dominating, but right. Why is T less than 1 in your graph is depicted like that vertical line?
Because I'm just saying that the range over which the power law is holding is just a very narrow range, because the cutoff, you know, this K star here, which is, you know, 1 over, you know, 1 minus T squared. So if T is 1/2, for example, then K star is like of the order of 4. So it's not very big.
But the more, the closer you get to t equal to 1, the...
Yeah, but I'm going to do that now. I'm going
to... The more you get closer to t equal to 1, you have the power law.
Yeah. So just bear with me. You know, if you don't mind, let me do one more little derivation. And if your question still remains, like, you know, hit me up again. So what I've done here is I've looked at the case t less than 1. Let's now look t equals 1. What happens then? And so in that case, we have power law over the entire range. Our distribution is 1 over k to the power 5/2. And so I'm going to determine k max by the same criterion as before, but it's just that I'm using a different functional form for ck. It's that the integral from x k max to infinity of dk divided by k to the power 5/2, this is equal to 1 over n. And in this case, if you do this integral, you're going to get that k max scales as n to the power 2/3. So right at the gelation point where the appearance of this infinite cluster first comes up, its size is infinite because it's as n goes to infinity, the size of this cluster is infinite. But if I divide by n the total size of the system, the fraction that's in the infinite cluster is only n to the minus 1/3. So it's an infinitesimal fraction for n going to infinity, but it's a huge number. And so these two answers, k max scaling like log n over 1 minus t squared or n to the 2/3, are the behaviors of the maximum cluster size in these different regions. And then the other thing you can get from this is now you can figure out, like, what happens, like, when this thing becomes of the order of n to the 2/3 is when this answer no longer applies. And so it's going to tell you something about where is the critical region. How close to t going to 1 do you have to be such that the exponential cutoff really doesn't matter and you're sort of in the region where you expect critical fluctuations a la what we've seen in phase transitions. So that is the little foray into extreme value statistics 101.
Is there a sudden jump from, is there a sudden jump at t equal to 1?
Is there a what?
Sudden jump.
Sudden jump.
In the k-max value?
No, I mean, well, the thing is that, no, it's just that this, as t approaches 1, so this answer, so as t gets close to 1, this answer will then sort of go smoothly into the end of the two-thirds. Once again, so what I've done is only kind of a rough estimate for the size of the maximum, but if we want to actually compute the distribution of the maximum value, then you'd see a full functional form, and you could see how it smoothly goes as t approaches 1 to just end of the two-thirds. There's no sudden jump, because the fact that the amplitude here is also going to diverge as t approaches 1.
My question was, when t is much less than 1, you have the exponential decay, but when you get close to t equal to 1, mm-hmm. you have the power law. But I feel like you drew it kind of the other way around, because... you said the early times is the initial, the first part of the graph, which is the power law, which doesn't make sense. Maybe I got it wrong. So is the part that is like the power law, the left hand of the
right? This part here is the power law here.
Is that the early times?
No. So the point is that as time is going on, it's just so at early times the distribution looks something like this. Later times is doing something like that. Still later doing something like that. And this knee is going out to infinity as a way to like time is approaching 1.
Yeah, but where is the exponential decay part?
So the exponential decay is the knee and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that the dominant contribution to this integral when t is approaching 1 is from this part, and the beyond the knee is playing no role for that part of the integral. Okay, so... maybe you can ask your tutorial instructor, what's the energy, the most energetic molecule in this room? Anybody thought about it yet? So think about it, because it's kind of fun.
Do the exact same thing with the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just do that. You find it's not relativistic, so you don't have to worry about relativity. Okay, so I have, you know, like maybe 6 or 7 minutes left to go. So I want to now turn to my next two topics about complex networks. Here, the Erdős-Reni random graph is kind of the simplest version of a complex network. And what I want to show now is a class of models that comes from, I mean, it was first invented by a guy named Yule's. It was Yule. He had a very strange name, Dudney Yule or something like that. And he actually invented this model in 1926. It was rediscovered in 1955 by Herbert Simon, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, of all things. And then it was rediscovered in 1999 by two people, Laszlo Barabasi and Reka Albert. I don't know if you've heard those names. And they became very famous very quickly for inventing the so-called Barabasi-Albert model, which is basically a rediscovery of this models from Yule and Simon from, you know, 30 years previous and another 30 years before that. But before we even get to the so-called scale-free network problem, let me talk about another very beautiful and simple model that kind of sets the stage for the story, which is a random recursive tree. And so what I'm trying to present to you are absolutely the simplest and most paradigmatic types of examples of complex networks. And so on the random recursive tree, let me tell you what the rules for how you grow a network is. Because the interesting thing here is that in many situations, like say the World Wide Web or like communication networks, you know, people join a network and one is interested in like, what is the structure of this network or the Facebook network, which I guess for you guys is all passe because that's for old farts like me to be in Facebook, even though I never go there because I'm too old for even Facebook. But anyways, the point is that these sorts of networks, it's very interesting to understand what is the structure of the network, because it's important to understand how to transmit information on the network. So the random recursive tree is a very trivial model, which is of that same sort of growing, that has a very simple growth mechanism that I want to now illustrate to you. So you start with a single node. Here's my node. And
in comes somebody else and attaches to this node. So that's the first step in the random recursive tree. Second step, as I have two nodes, I pick one of them at random. So let's say I pick this guy, and then I attach to that node. Now I have three nodes. I pick one of them at random. Let's pick this guy. Now I have four nodes. I pick with probably one quarter. I pick any one of these nodes. Maybe I pick this guy, etc. And that's the growth mechanism of the random recursive tree. So you see that it's incredibly simple. I can explain it in just like two lines of code. Pick a node, attach to it. Pick a random node, attach to it. Just do that over and over again. And a natural question that one might ask is, what is the degree distribution of this network? And the part of the reason I'm like belaboring this simple example is that when we get to the case of scale-free networks, it's a little bit less trivial to derive the distribution, but it turns out the techniques I'm going to show you to derive the degree distribution here will go over line by line for scale-free networks, and you can derive things in a very nice way by the approach I'm going to show you now. So let me call capital NK is equal to the number of nodes of degree K. And once again, and hopefully this is going to start looking familiar to you, we want to write down an evolution equation for this number of nodes of degree K. And so let me write down such an equation, which is, how does the number of nodes of degree K change every time I add one new node to the network? And so I'm interested in dnk, the change every time I add a new node. So here, capital N is sort of like a time-like variable here. It's the natural measure of how big the network is. And I want to ask, how does this act? And in fact, let me write here average number of nodes, just to be really pedantic and correct. So this is the average number of nodes of degree k. So how does this change? Well, there's two ways a number of nodes of degree k can change. I could, by bad or good luck, I can pick a node of degree k and attach to it, and that decreases the number of nodes of degree k. So there's a loss term, minus nk, because I pick a node of degree k with the probability nk divided by n, and I lose one node of degree k. So there's a loss term. There is a gain term, because I could pick a node of degree k minus 1 and attach to it, and thereby create a node of degree k. And so there's a term here, plus nk minus 1 divided by n. And there's one more piece to this equation, which is that every time I add a new node to the network, so here comes my latest new node, I've now created here a node of degree 4, but this node, by construction, has degree 1. So the tail of the arrow that's coming in has degree 1. So the new node always has degree 1. So I'm always inputting nodes of degree 1 all the time. So I should put in a 1 for nodes of degree 1. And the simplest way of putting in a 1 for nodes of degree 1 is put delta k 1. So that is my equation that I want to solve. And I've got maybe 90 seconds to solve it. So maybe I'll leave you in suspense. But so what I'll do next time is I'll start here, and we'll learn how to solve this equation. And then I'll show you like faster ways to solve it rather than just sort of doing what I'm going to do, which is just one by one solving them sequentially. And then we'll learn how to solve scale-free networks. And that kind of brings us to the end of the whole story about complex networks. So I guess that's it for today. Questions of any kind?
Why did you add the delta again?
Because the tail of the arrow, every time I add a new node, there's always a node of degree 1 that's been created. Mm-hmm. And so that creation is, I have to always add a 1 for nodes of degree 1. So that's why that's there.
If we change the link probability in the Erdős-Reinl model, is there any phase transition?
What do you mean change the link probability?
We can change the probability of linking the two nodes. It is the way it's constructed in the Erdős-Reinl model.
Well, so in the Erdős-Reinl, you just say that the link that the link probability is independent of anything. I just put a link between any two nodes. Yes, if you change the way that you're doing the linking, you can change the nature of the phase transition itself. But it's like the case of random linking is kind of the most natural. But
you know, one could imagine putting in links with a probably proportional to the size of the cluster or something like that.
Well, I mean, we still keep the probability constant, but like for the small probability, maybe the graph can, the average nodes can be increased very slowly, but when the P is very large, then.
Well, but P is only going between, I mean, what are you calling P here?
Like the probability of two links be collected.
Okay, but so that probability can only be between 0 and 1. Yeah.
If it is 1, then.
Then everybody's connected.
Yes, and if it is 0, then it is not connected. So we
right.
Need some between.
Yes, so that, but that phase transition is a function of P. So, you know, there's two sort of equivalent ways of thinking about the Erdős-Rényi random graph. You can think about it statically, where you say there's a probability P of linking every pair of nodes, or you could have a rate at which you're putting in links. And so if I stop my movie such that the number of links is sort of equal to your P, then they're actually the same process. And so your process is like an equilibrium process, because you're saying, I just, you know, put in, I say that each link is there with probability P or 1 minus P. I'm doing a non-equilibrium process because I argue that it's actually easier to solve for the degree distribution. But the two processes are entirely equivalent. Okay. I guess that's it. So we have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday lecture this week, and then next week, Monday, Tuesday. Is that correct? Okay.